Welcome back to another week at the Damage Report, everybody. I'm John Adirola. It's Monday, so Brooke is of course here. Brooke, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Glad to Good always to be here on Mondays.
Be here on Mondays and pretty much every day now, because you're also doing more work behind the scenes on the show as well.
Yeah.
And you're here for a great day in the news, because a lot is going on. We're gonna have a little bit of analysis of some of the fallout from CPAC over the weekend, including Donald Trump's just bananas speech. That's gonna be fun. We've got some interesting stats on Trump followers and his odds in the 2020 re-election bid that he is of course going to launch. Another launch, that is Bernie Sanders' campaign, two big speeches in Brooklyn and Chicago. We're gonna be breaking down some of that, some of what Bernie said, but also some of what some of the people who are introducing him, friends of the show, who were their speeches were kind of more exciting even. We're gonna be breaking down some of that as well. And also we've got two awesome in-studio guests. So in just a little bit, we're gonna be joined by Felonious Monk, who's going to be talking about his own personal experience with getting the vote back after spending time in prison and talking about the need to reform that nationwide. Later on in the show, author David Wallace Wells is gonna be joining us to talk about his book, The Uninhabitable Earth, to talk about some of the potential risks that we face if we don't do what is necessary in regards to climate change. So big show, why don't we jump into it?
Let's do it.
CPAC is a place where the crazies go. I think that's what the first C is actually for. It's not just for conservatives, it is for the most, it's for conservatives to go to try to get noticed. Say crazy offensive things, because that is the way that you stand out on the right now. Well, king on top of that pile of poo is Donald Trump himself, who went and supposedly had a speech and instead ad-libbed for over 2 hours, which is to his credit. It takes a particular sort of unexpected virility on his part to be able to speak for that long. But to speak in the way that he did, it takes a certain type of mania. And so we're gonna get into just a little bit of that. So first of all, as he's coming out, how does he introduce himself? This might look familiar if you've seen the intro to this show. That wasn't weird at all. So the reason he did that is because the standards and expectations on the right are dropping precipitously. So it used to be you'd wear a flag lapel pin, or you would say, you know, oh, God bless America, you'd say something. Now you literally just grope a flag. And I don't know what comes after that. I don't think any of us wants to know what comes after that, but that was the intro.
To the longest speech, reportedly at
it's
least.
It's still going. Actually, we're gonna have live updates.
Yeah.
Why don't we get into some of the substance?
Okay.
So understand that we're gonna be jumping around. The reason is that he was jumping around. He would talk about Robert Mueller and then go to tariffs and then go to made up names and then go back to Robert Mueller. So first, here is his thoughts on one of his, remember, closest allies, Jeff Sessions, one of the first people to declare for him and to support him from the very beginning. This is how he talked about him.
The Attorney General says, I'm gonna recuse myself. I'm gonna recuse. And I said, why the hell didn't he tell me that before I put him in?
Okay, so obviously there's a lot of things that were considered sort of, you have to do these things and respect these things to be a serious Republican in the past. We just crossed another one off the list. You can literally just make fun of Southern accents.
I mean,
all the Southerners are like, yeah, we sound stupid.
I was gonna say, like, that's your strongest and voting base there, bud.
This is a group of people that pay to get slapped in the face.
Also, just, him and look, you brought up like him talking about a lot of people and kind of making fun of people, but a lot of he just like neglected to point out that he appointed these people.
Mm-hmm.
These are products of your decision making.
Yeah.
And why didn't you tell me that you were gonna recuse yourself? One, you should have been able to see ahead to that just because of intelligence. Two, that's so weird to stand up there and admit that you want people in place who would protect you from this Russia investigation. Mm-hmm. That was a weird tell that maybe that's part of it you shouldn't have said. You can't talk about being mad at him for not protecting you.
Yeah, so there's
from
a lot
something
of
that you're saying is going, nothing's gonna come of it anyway.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, you would not need any protection if there was nothing to be protected against.
Right.
And there's a lot of stuff that for, if you were a fan of Trump and you were a critical thinker, you would have had many reasons over the past couple of years to be very worried about the weird lies and backtracks and, you know, conflicting accounts of what happened during the campaign, what has happened since the campaign. This one is, that's effectively an admission
right.
of guilt. That I, so this guy, Jeff Sessions, hardcore, hard right conservative, terrible on any number of different issues, the perfect guy to push his anti-civil rights, anti-legal drug use, anti all these things, criminal justice reform, all of that, all the bad things Jeff Sessions has done, all of that Trump would have been like, forget it, I don't need it. The only standard is whether you will protect me from this investigation that I swear I didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
How is that, like if you can slide by and not think that that's admission, I don't know what to say to you at this point.
Right.
But that's the way he talks about him. So he's a big fan of mocking his friends. So he talks about his friends on the phone with him. It's just a weird thing, but take a look at this.
Mr. President, sir.
Hashtag 25th Amendment, hashtag nuclear codes. There was so many, like we don't have time to cut through, we're not the Guardian. We don't have time to go through the whole 2.5 hour speech and cut all the crazy things. You can watch, I think John Oliver had a great sum up on Sunday of some of them. He's out of his mind. And any sort of expectation of respect or gravitas, the idea that if you're gonna be president, you should deserve the role, you should have earned the role, you should be the best of us, at least in some respects, 100% gone. All they want is the best right-wing troll. Someone who's going to make fun of things, doesn't matter if it's true, they don't care if it's true. They just want someone who's going to make them laugh a little bit as the American ship sinks below the waves.
Right, that was like a common theme of this speech. It doesn't matter if it's true.
Mm-hmm.
Because we talked about this weird phenomenon that people are, right-wingers are like grasping a hold of this, post-failed abortion baby murder,
mm-hmm.
which, what?
Yeah.
And the racism, when he started talking about immigrants, it's hard to watch, honestly. It's not funny, it's not cute, it's not funny to be like, oh, he's so crazy. It's disappointing, it's embarrassing, mm-hmm. it's awful.
It should be scary.
Yeah.
Because again, this guy, if he wanted to right now, unless something crazy happened that isn't in the codes in any way, but he could launch a nuclear weapon if he wants to. And he's up there hugging flags and look, the blatant lying, saying that undocumented immigrants that are released and told to come back for a court date, he said 3% show up. Depending on which program you're talking about, it's between 76% and more than 90%. Right. So you go from what he says 3%, and everyone in that audience now will believe that to the end of their days. They can never be shaken from that belief. He was only off by 74 to 89% or so. And that's the president, and that's the level of lying. We're not gonna do all the fact checking that we could do. I'm so sick of it at this point, but just blatant disregard for the truth.
So much irony. Also, the most anti-press president that at least I've ever seen,
mm-hmm.
Went on this long rant about the need for free speech protections on mm-hmm. college campuses, and it's like, whoa, that's confusing.
Except. I mean, it's confusing from the point of view of a person who is relatively rational. From the point of view of a person in that crowd, just say on Twitter and on college campuses, they're mean to us and they will eat it up. You can get a book deal saying that, you can get a show on Fox Nation or whatever, just say that they're being unfair to you. So I wanna add, so we had the flag, mm-hmm. grope it like a weirdo. So now the relationship with nationalism, patriotism, all that is sort of weirdly changed. Mocking Southern accents, totally cool, totally expected. Mock my accent, just make fun of me. Not me, I'm talking about his fans.
Hold on, one more. Okay.
He's talking about Dave Weigel. So Washington Post reporter, he says lied about the attendance at one of his crowds because there's literally nothing in this world he cares more about than the attendance at his crowds. He talked again about his inauguration crowd there. Said that he had lied about how many people were there, and it was some weird way he got around to that he was late to one. He said he got there too early and took a photo, but then later said he got there too late because he doesn't fly private. And the crowd just laughed. The idea that a reporter flies on commercial airlines is a punchline now. First of all, I don't know any reporter that flies around the country on private airlines, but the idea there is, I fly on private airlines and these peasants don't. And CPAC laughed. Again, what I would have said in the past was, they used to think that being an elitist was a bad thing. That's right. What the liberals were, the elitists. But now they've changed to, we wanna be the elitists. But that's not true either. They still hold the elitists are a bad thing and now make fun of people for not flying private. They maintain both of those things at the same time.
Because nothing makes sense.
No, nothing makes sense.
Yeah.
They think simultaneously, it's horrible if you're rich and thank God the richest guy is on our side. It's horrible if you have privilege and thank God our president flies private and all that. Nothing makes any sense. It is just a swirling vortex of insanity, but they had fun there. It was entertaining. I don't doubt that every single person in that crowd thought this was the best speech a president has ever given. When it doesn't even really rise to the level of being deigned speech. Anyway, there was more on the Green New Deal, his massive lies on that. I'm not gonna go through it all. You've heard many of them before, but just understand that they're going to lie about our policies. They're gonna call it communism. They're gonna do whatever. Just expect that. That's baked into the equation at this point. It should not stop you. It should not stall you. It should not slow you down in pushing for the policies that America needs. With that said, we are gonna take a break. We come back. Felonious Monk is in studio to talk voting rights after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called The Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of The Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Last November's midterms, thankfully, the voters of Florida re-enfranchised over 1 million felons who had lost the ability to vote. But the situation is not thus solved. In many parts of the country, it is still either impossible to ever vote after spending time in prison, or the process of getting your rights back is needlessly complex. And I want to invite to the show now someone who has experienced this process. Comedian Felonious Monk, welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's hi.
Hi.
It's great to have you here.
It's great to like be here. And as I said off air, it's great to also be able to vote and make decisions that affect people. You guys be nice to me. It's the idea that you can't ever vote just seems on its face ridiculous, right? Mm-hmm. Like how can a person who is being taxed and working and participating in every other part of this country not able to participate in determining who's going to govern it? But 13th Amendment, right? It's it's a lot of stuff that we need to unpack. And so shout out to AOC. It's good to have people now who are participating. It's great to see what's going on in Florida. And it's scary if you're a Republican in Florida to see this many people now enfranchised again. So Virginia, same thing. We're coming for you. And I'm the worst of the worst, so.
Oh my goodness.
Well, look, you talked about how scary it is for some in Florida. I mean, DeSantis seemed like he was going to try to stop this from going to effect, but thankfully there was a public outcry, and so he was stopped from doing that. So I want to talk about your experience in particular. So you spent time in prison, you came back out. You're in a state where it is possible to get your voting rights back, and you did, but there's many people who don't know even there that they can experience the same thing that you did, correct?
Yeah, and you know, the idea that
why is it that they don't know?
Well, I think just even on a national level, there are people who live in states where you automatically get your rights back after you've completed your time. And there's this idea, we've all been conditioned to believe that you're a felon, felons can't vote. Mm-hmm. I don't know where that originated, but that's not true except in a very few states. Mm-hmm. In fact, there are two states where you can vote while you're still in prison. There are multiple states that the second you get out, Vermont
Maine
and Maine,
Vermont.
You can get out. And there's several states that the second you're out of prison, you can vote. There are several states that the second you're off parole or probation, you can vote immediately. So Virginia is one of those weird states where you have to apply for it, mm-hmm. But up until maybe 3 years ago, if you applied, there were only 2% of the people who applied received their rights back. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, in the last 2 or 3 years, it's just a flood of people getting their rights back. And I was one of those guys. I literally just applied online. I didn't do anything special. I didn't call in a favor. You know, The Rock didn't love me. He probably does, but that's not what happened. You know, I just applied online on their restored.whatever website, and it happened. And, you know, the second part to that is you can also apply to get, like, your gun rights back. Like, it's not just this one-stop thing. You can vote. You can get all of your rights back. But we are all conditioned to believe that felons can't. And it literally, I cried like a, you know, like a gangster baby, because I'm still a gangster, you know what I mean? But a gangster baby.
Still have feelings.
But that was powerful for you.
It was absolutely powerful. It's been 20-plus years. I've been home 21 years. And I was under the impression that this never happens. Wow. And so when you find out, you know, I missed both Barack Obama elections, right? That's an election that you want to participate in. I missed 2016, a chance to vote for potentially the first woman president. And, of course, we ended up with a guy with, you know, who that guy is.
I've heard about him.
We've heard.
He sounds rough.
He's on the news occasionally. and so now I have an opportunity to help get that guy out of office. That's as important as anything I've done other than being a parent to two amazing kids. Love you, kids. Really, if you see this online, I do care about you.
You were talking about like people not knowing. You told a story about a friend, right, mm-hmm. who noticed your post. Tell that story.
Yeah, so my friend Nathaniel is, he sent me a DM on Instagram, and he goes, hey, what's the website to check? What do I need to do? No, he didn't say to check. He said, what's the website? I need to start this process today. 30 minutes later, he sends me another message and goes, does this mean I have my rights back? And it said restored already. His rights had been restored in 2017. He didn't know that because none of us knew to check. Mm-hmm. And so that's how big just getting the information out there. This is huge. Just being here today, given an opportunity to get all of your viewers who are out there watching. If you have a family member, have them check.
Right.
They may have their rights back, right? They may already be able to participate in what, you know, for a lot of people, it's like, oh, well, my voice doesn't matter. Well, part of the reason our voices don't matter is because so many of us have been disenfranchised who believe like others believe. Yeah. And if you give us the franchise back, you know, again, I think Florida goes from being, you know, reddish purple to clearly blue. Mm-hmm. You know, Virginia could go, again, another toss-up state goes from reddish purple to clearly blue.
Yeah.
You know, imagine a blue Kentucky. Imagine a blue Texas. Mm-hmm. Imagine all of these states where people have been disenfranchised, all of a sudden enfranchised again.
Yeah.
What does that do to the future of our national elections going forward? So yeah. I'm out here just, I'm absolutely, you know, politicking for my guy every time. And I don't know if you could see this color, but that's the way I'm going. Down, all the way down ticket, buddy. Feel how you feel. You see it?
Feel how you feel.
I could fight, too, still. Nothing's changed. No, everything, just because I'm free, I eat for everybody. EA Sport, these are in the game, buddy. Know what you want. I'm still a comedian at the end of the day.
I noticed, actually. So you were talking about some geography there. Mm-hmm. So in your piece, in essence, and mm-hmm. when Brooke was doing some more research on this, we noticed that you talk about some places where you automatically get your rights back, like Maine and Vermont. And then we noticed a sort of pattern to the places where it's really tough. And I'm not a historian,
right?
So I don't know why in the South.
I don't know, it's so crazy. it's such a weird thing. It's very clear that places that have, you know, if not a black majority, a black plurality, where there are just tons and tons of black people and brown people who would affect state elections, mm-hmm. right? Like if you've had 30 years of Republican governors and you realize you've also disenfranchised 800,000 voters and your votes are won by 120,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, yeah, if I'm in Mississippi, I don't want those people mm-hmm. to vote, right? If I'm in Virginia, I don't want those people to vote. And, you know, it's historically accurate. We talked about Maine and Vermont, right. Places where you can still vote while you're in prison. Well, those are places that have, you know, less than 10% of the entire population is black or brown. Not just black, very specifically black or brown.
Yeah.
So you can have your rights back immediately. I think it's 5% in Vermont. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, if you get locked up, you can still vote because we don't want a white guy who owns property when he comes out of prison to not have his vote.
Yeah.
But you over there, you know, Jamal, you shouldn't vote. And so, yeah, if you go to Alabama, Mississippi, North Carolina, Virginia, Georgia, Florida, until very recently, mm-hmm. yeah, you can't vote.
Yeah.
And it's not because you're a felon. It's because you're a black or brown felon. Man, you guys can't beat me up, so I can say what I want to say.
Whatever. It is interesting, though, kind of on the same lines as the places where it's the hardest to vote, mm-hmm. but also maybe kind of the same reasoning why the places where it is easiest to get, not easiest, but where mm-hmm. You can potentially get your voting rights restored, people don't talk about it. You mentioned parole officers don't right. talk about it. Yeah.
Well, I mean,
it's not advertised.
Yeah, I mean, if you know, the entire process of being incarcerated is to dehumanize you, right? Mm-hmm. And so people go, well, it's your fault. Okay, well, that's fine. But once you walk into that building and they tell you to squat and cough and take your clothes, these are things that in your brain right now, if I said, Brooke, 10 minutes from now, squat and cough, you're like, oh no.
Yeah. That's right? Exactly how it would look.
And then you, right, she was like, she would immediately, oh no.
Exactly how it would look.
Monk, that's just weird.
Exactly. So
imagine having your name taken away and being given a number, right? And then the very first thing they do is to say, take all your clothes off, turn around and expose the most vulnerable part of yourself, cough, and then from henceforth and forevermore, this is who you are to me. And this is our relationship. So, going forward, having a parole or probation officer who doesn't give you information that's going to benefit you isn't weird.
Yeah,
that makes perfect sense because you're not a person. You are an inmate or an ex-felon or, you know, Felonious Monk is a joke. It's a play on the idea that, you know, this is where I came from. But it's also an acknowledgement of how a lot of people will see me no matter what I do. Again, been home 20 years. Still, the number of stories that are written about me that are based on what I did 20 plus years ago. You know, Washington Post did an article on a play that I wrote that was nominated for a Helen Hayes Award. And the title of that article was, Ex-drug dealer wants to say more than sorry. I hadn't sold drugs in 25 years, but the title of this article was extra, not father of two, not husband of one, not guy who did some really cool stuff on the nightly show. Ex-drug dealer.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, when a parole officer doesn't give you this information, it's because they don't care about you voting or participating in society. They care about you not getting a dirty urine and keeping a job.
Yeah.
I just happen to be funny enough to have made a living and get a platform that's big enough for people to care about it, right? But there are a lot of guys out there who are struggling just to get a Social Security card because they don't have the documentation necessary after they got out of prison, or who didn't have the family structure in place when they came home to have somewhere to live, somewhere to feel safe, stable, to have their, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, basic levels met, so they could do the next thing. I happen to have those things and also to think that I'm good enough to do more than, you know, just survive out here.
Yeah.
Most of us don't have that gift. Most of us don't have that blessing. So I'm lucky, and I appreciate you guys giving me an opportunity to talk about, you know, how lucky I am.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you using your platform for such an important issue, and especially at a time when it seems like finally, maybe there will be progress if people keep their eyes on the prize and don't forget about these issues.
Yeah. Plus nice t-shirts.
What's that?
We'll talk about nice t-shirts off air.
I would love to.
You guys bonding over t-shirts?
I wear a lot on air, actually. Well, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you guys for having me.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Brooke. Yeah. Thank you, John.
Thank you. Anytime.
Thank you, people. Remember,
watch yourself, people.
Everyone.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. We come back. A couple of dueling speeches of the weekend from Bernie Sanders launching his 2020 presidential bid. We'll break those down after this. I want to delve once again, even just briefly, into the cult of Trump and the way that he maintains his vice grip on both his base and the media arm of the Republican Party in Fox News. So just a couple of scary statistics because I want you to start off the week horrified. So 40% of the country in a recent poll says that they want to see him reelected. Now that is lower than most other presidents at this point, other than Bill Clinton, who I think was at 38% at this same time. But that's 40%. I mean, how much more does he need to lock down to get reelected? So if you have any hopes that, we're just gonna slide through this thing, no big deal, and maybe big deal. Also, interesting stat, after the Michael Cohen testimony, after everything that we've learned over the past couple of years, Catherine Rampell tweeted out, NBC survey, 37% say they believe Trump has been honest and truthful when it comes to the Russia probe. That's the craziest thing I've ever read. I mean, look, not only do we know that he's lied about multiple aspects of it and then had to change his story or contradict himself, he continually every day lies about the very nature of the investigation itself, saying that it's illegal, that it's unconstitutional that he's being investigated. That is simply an incorrect statement of fact right there. But people believe that in all of what he has said for 2 years about this investigation, he has never once lied about it. So again, vice grip on his base when it comes to this topic. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure they're going to be very open-minded when the Mueller report comes out. If it does have something that looks bad for him, they're going to absorb that and integrate it into their worldview.
What's so fascinating is that he could actually tell the truth. And I don't think his base would be shaken.
I mean, if he said, yeah.
It would be manipulated to, he did what he had to do. Mm-hmm. You know.
Oh, 100%. I 100% agree. And it might, maybe we'll get to that point. We'll see. But I want to go a little bit farther into this, into how Fox News has protected him since even before he was elected. So in the New Yorker, Jane Meyer had a write-up about a very interesting fact. So according to Meyer, as the 2016 presidential campaign was in its final stretch back in 2016, FoxNews.com reporter Diana Falzone had, quote, obtained proof about Trump's affair with Stormy Daniels and had confirmed it with Daniels' manager and former husband. She also had emails between Daniels' lawyer and Michael Cohen about the hush payment and non-disclosure agreement to keep Daniels from speaking out. But the story never came out in advance of the election. Editors kept punting on it, and former Fox executive Ken LaCourte reportedly told Falzone, quote, good reporting, kiddo, but Rupert wants Donald Trump to win, so just let it go. Referring to media mogul Rupert Murdoch, who created Fox News. So they had a gigantic story that could have damaged, in an incredibly close election, his chances of winning. And they said, no, we're not gonna do it. And remember, this is just like a week or two after Tucker Carlson was like, we've never been told what to say, what to report on. Except when an election is, you know, up for grabs.
That was so, not, I shouldn't say funny, because it's horrible. But isn't that a conversation that you imagine happens all the time?
Oh, about stories like that?
Yeah.
Just in Fox News?
Yes, right.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, look, they it's projection, Tucker Carlson saying that they're not told what to say. I've never seen talking points disseminate more quickly than through the hosts on Fox News.
Right.
They talk about issues in the exact same way. They push the exact same stories. What, they're not twins. Like, somewhere it's coming from, and I would say it's from the top. Another thing, though, and this is just kind of funny, the ridiculous symbiotic relationship that Donald Trump has with hosts on Fox News. So sources that know him and worked with him for literally years say he wakes up to watch Fox and Friends because he literally sees them as his friends. This is a guy who doesn't really have friends outside of that. And he's told confidants that he's ranked the loyalty of many reporters on a scale of 1 to 10. Brett Baer, the chief political anchor for Fox News, is at a 6. Sean Hannity is at a 10. Steve Doocy is so adoring that Trump gives him a 12. A sort of rating that only Dog Rates does on Twitter as a joke. But Steve Doocy is so mindless in his devotion to Donald Trump that he has broken the scale. So, if Steve Doocy has any belief anymore that he's a journalist, that he's a true part of media and not just a cheerleader for the most radical president of our lifetime and possibly several lifetimes before that, that should be gone. Just like with Sean Hannity, understand, Trump does not respect you at all. He cares only about your loyalty, Steve Doocy. If you ever contradict him, if you ever point out an inconvenient truth, it's done. There's your access, gone. All that you think you've built up could be gone in the snap of fingers.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, not even if you do anything wrong, if the public perception against you changes, sorry.
Yeah, it can all be over.
Even super loyal people, like look what's happening at the border. Mm-hmm. You know, like you sign on to that mess and damage your entire reputation, and then you're disposable.
Yeah. Yeah, and even for the people who live along the border, they could be the most hardcore rally going Trump supporters in the world.
And he will
send in the military and take your land.
I was gonna say,
so. Leave me my hat at least, come on. And you can walk to new property. Okay, let's turn to another topic. Over the weekend, Bernie Sanders had the big launch of his campaign, the formal launch, with a big speech in Brooklyn. The following day, a more specifically issue focused on race and politics speech in Chicago the next day. Very exciting speeches. Most of what Bernie Sanders said, you've heard before if you were a fan, if you followed his speeches. He did talk more about his own personal biography, which is not a thing that he normally does. So I want to read a couple excerpts of that. He said, I am not going to tell you that I grew up in a home of desperate poverty. That would not be true. But what I will tell you is that coming from a lower middle class family, I will never forget how money, or really lack of money, was always a point of stress in our family. I did not have a father who gave me millions of dollars to build luxury skyscrapers, casinos, and country clubs. I did not come from a family of privilege that prepared me to entertain people on television by telling workers, you're fired. Again, how do you get elected in this time amongst a population that feels so left behind economically by a guy who became famous by firing people? It's amazing that worked. And Bernie Sanders is going to point that out throughout the election.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating. He doesn't talk about himself, and that's not a bad thing. He doesn't talk about himself. Doesn't like to. There was an excerpt from a friend, and I'm losing the name, but saying we're best friends, and I don't know if he has grandkids or even a wife. So I think it's nice. It's he got some advice from someone. You've got to do things, I guess, a little different this
time
around.
Some people might say that as cold. Or like you're less human, maybe.
Maybe.
I don't think his fans, like, I never felt like, why doesn't he talk about his hobbies?
Right.
I never felt that or anything. But some people do like to know. They want to feel like they can go get a beer.
It
I guess they'll go
be.
With a beer if you know them a little bit better.
Nice for people to hear him talk a little bit more about himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He also says, my activities here in Chicago taught me a very important lesson that I have never forgotten. And that is that whether it is the struggle against corporate greed or against racism, sexism, homophobia, environmental devastation, or war and militarism, real change never takes place from top on down. It always takes place from the bottom on up. So that, of course, is the core sort of message of his campaign and of his campaign back in 2016. I also want to say, if you haven't caught some of the speeches, not of Bernie Sanders, but of three people who introduced him. So Ro Khanna, Sean King, and Nina Turner had great speeches. I wasn't watching live when it was happening, but I knew when Nina Turner started talking because Twitter blew up over Nina Turner. She's great, one of my favorite people to have on the show. She's awesome. Honestly, like, as she was doing that speech, I was thinking, I mean, I love Bernie, but why isn't Nita running as well? She was getting everybody fired up. Anyway, very exciting times. There'll be more to come. I wish we could go more in depth, but we do have to move on. We're going to take a short break. We come back. Author David Wallace Wells is going to be in studio to talk about his book, The Uninhabitable Earth, and the future of what might happen if we don't deal with climate change after this. Seems like finally, at long last, people are starting to understand not only that climate change is happening, but that the time length that we have to actually do something about it is shorter than perhaps we might wish. And joining us now to talk about that, an author who understands the stakes and the timeline, David Wallace Wells, author of The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. Welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Very excited to have you here. So you are not sort of like dipping your toe in this, maybe it's scary, maybe it's not. It's the uninhabitable Earth. And the first line in your book is, it's much, much worse than you think. So why did you start off with that? For your framing the issue in a particular way, why is that?
Well, the science is that scary. Mm-hmm. I'm not an alarmist in the sense that I'm adding a lot of hyperbole or conjecture onto the best science that we have. It's just the case that when you look at what warming will mean at levels of 2, 3, and 4 degrees, which is basically our best case scenario up to what we're on track for by the end of the century, it's truly terrifying. At 4 degrees, we're talking about $600 trillion in global climate damages. That's double all the wealth that exists in the world today. Places in the world could be hit by 6 simultaneous climate-driven natural disasters at once. We'd have hundreds of millions of climate refugees, twice as much war. The wildfires in California could be 64 times more intense than they were last year when they burned more than 1 million acres.
And so killed a lot of people.
That is, the facts themselves, the science itself is alarming. What I'm trying to do is, first of all, lay it out so that we can all see it really clearly. I think that's important in part because the public hasn't yet reckoned with really where we're headed. And then also to think a little bit about what the world will look like, how we'll interact with one another, how it will affect our politics, our geopolitics, our culture and storytelling, to be living in a world that's degraded by those forces, because I think this is an all-encompassing story. It will touch every aspect of life in the coming decades, and we haven't really yet begun to think about what that would mean beyond the narrow scientific questions.
So we were talking before we went live, and I was talking about my experience dealing with climate scientists and how they are very careful not to overstate things beyond their personal experience in doing research and all that. And I've been frustrated with that because I believe that the stakes are so high. Some might respond to your book saying that you're being an alarmist, but it appears that you're not stepping 1 inch past where the science is at, but a lot of the scientists are only talking like a mile behind where the science is at, and at the same time are being attacked as being part of some sort of global paid conspiracy to convince people that we need to get rid of cows or something.
Yeah.
Do you think that with people paying more attention to this, more extreme weather events driving news coverage of it, do you think that the attempt to derail conversation about these issues as just calling them extremists, or they're exaggerating how much we need to do and how short we need to do it, do you think that that's likely to work, or do you think that people are becoming more savvy?
My sense is that the politics is moving really quickly, and there's much more concern about climate than there was just a few years ago. So the polls say that 73% of Americans believe climate change is real and happening now. 70% of us are concerned about it. Those numbers are up 15% since since 2015. They're up 8% since March, which is really fast. Oh. And by any political science measure, it's rapid. But by the standard of the timeline of action that we have, it's actually quite slow. We need that movement even faster and much more dramatic movement to really change our politics and our policy.
Yeah.
That's really where I think we need to be focused. There's a lot of talk about lifestyle choices and what you eat, how you travel, that kind of thing. People who want to act that way and reduce their carbon footprint should. But to me, the scale of the challenge is so large, it can only be addressed through policy. Mm-hmm. And we need to really transform our politics, not just in the US, which is only 15% of global emissions, but globally, in order to introduce policy that has a chance of really averting these worst case outcomes.
Yeah. So you've been talking about some of what might happen, some of the downsides if climate change happens, but let's talk about some of the upsides to doing something about it. So in your book, you do get into sort of the positive economic argument for actually caring and doing something. So what does that look like?
Yeah, up until just a few years ago, there was a kind of economic conventional wisdom that held that action on climate would be very expensive. It would mean a huge upfront investment, and it would also mean foregoing some amount of economic growth. I think that's one main reason we've had such slow action on climate over the last few decades. And we've basically had no action. Mm-hmm. I mean, our emissions are still growing. We've known this problem for a long time. In fact, half of all the emissions we've put into the atmosphere in the entire history of humanity have come in the last 30 years, since Al Gore published his first book on warming, since the UN established the IPCC. So the knowledge about climate change has not actually directed us to take action on it. I think that has been in part because of this conventional wisdom from economists that said that it would be too expensive. But that's all really changed just in the last few years. In part, sadly, because we now understand how much more expensive the impacts of climate change will be than we appreciated before. But comparing that to the cost of action, it's now clear that fast action will add an enormous amount of wealth compared to slow action. Mm-hmm. There was a big study last year that said that we could add $26 trillion to the global economy by just 2030 through rapid decarbonization. That's a lot of money, very fast. I don't think it's yet really percolated up into the minds of our policymakers, but I think it will happen soon because it is the new economic conventional wisdom. And when it does, I think that our policy will really start to change quite quickly. Yeah. Again, the question is whether it'll be quickly enough, whether the action it inspires will be dramatic enough, because the UN says we need to halve our global emissions by 2030 to avert a catastrophic level of warming. We think about this in terms of energy. Energy is the easiest part of it. There's also infrastructure, agriculture, transportation, industry. All of these sectors have to be completely rebuilt, and 12 years is just not a lot of time to do that. In fact, I think it's practically impossible.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Scary. Again, that was supposed to be the positive part.
Well, it's important to keep in mind that, you know, no matter how bad it gets, the climate will still be within our control. So when we talk about these really horrifying climate impacts, even the ones that are just a few decades away, for instance, that the biggest cities in the Middle East will become unlivably hot by 2050, creating tens of millions of climate refugees, that will only happen if we act poorly now.
Yeah.
It is not set in stone. It's not the result of something that happened a generation ago or two generations ago. And even if we get to a quite hellish level of warming, it will still be the case that how much carbon we put into the atmosphere at that point will determine the future climate of the decade ahead and how much climate suffering there will be then. We'll be able to avert climate suffering if we choose to not emit more carbon. And that, I think, is really important to remember. However horrified you may be by climate change, the scale of those horrors is really a reminder that we retain almost total control over the climate system. And if we bring these horrors into being, it will be because we have effectively chosen to do so.
Yeah, and that I heard, I think it was on Howard Schultz's CNN panel that he did, he said, they want to renovate X number of buildings. You can't do that in 5 years, as if doing 90% of that or 70% of that isn't better than doing 0% of it. It's this weird absolutist way of thinking. But I am curious though, in terms of national conversations about policy, I am very excited that the Green New Deal has started people talking week after week after week about these issues. Do you think that the way that that's playing out so far over the past couple of months, does that give you hope that we're more likely to do something?
Absolutely. I mean, I mentioned the polling numbers before. I think that political activism is just as dramatic and exciting, not just in the US. You've got Greta Thunberg and this climate strike in Europe, Extinction Rebellion in the UK, Sunrise here. And the way it's led to the Green New Deal is completely amazing. I mean, even 5 years ago, certainly 10 years ago, the Democratic Party considered cap and trade too ambitious a climate policy. And now we're dealing with this proposal, which is still preliminary. There are huge questions about exactly how it would roll out and what it would mean. It's really just a statement of principles rather than true legislation. But still, you have all of the major Democratic presidential candidates signing onto it. That's a huge change in the party's commitment to this issue.
In just a few years.
Just a couple years, which is incredible and exhilarating. And I think the most exciting thing about that that piece of legislation is that it really does put the science first. It doesn't define what is politically possible as the goal. It takes what the UN's science committee says is necessary and then builds backward from there to try to find a politics that can fulfill those demands. That's a complete reversal of how American politics on climate used to work. And that's probably the most exciting part to me, that we're putting science first and taking our direction from the scientists.
Yeah, it's a novel approach that I would define as how government should function in literally every case.
Absolutely.
But doesn't, as you point out. David, thank you so much for joining us. The book is The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. Very exciting stuff. Thank you for taking the threat seriously and delving into so many different aspects of this, from, as we talked about, the economy and all that, but you get into the military, you get into a lot of different topics. So thank you for that.
Appreciate it.
Great to have you in. We're gonna take a short break, everybody. When we come back, one more topic to get to. We'll be back in just a few. If you care at all about police being held accountable for what they do, it has been a bad week in two different cases of police officers killing unarmed black men and then getting away with it. Let's return to two topics we have talked about before. This is Stephon Clark and Terrence Crutcher. So in the case of Stephon Clark, the Sacramento County District Attorney Anne-Marie Schubert announced that the two officers who shot and killed him, they were just abiding by what they were supposed to be doing. Take a look at this quote from the DA. Was a crime committed? There's no question that a human being died. But when we look at the facts in the law and we follow our ethical responsibilities, the answer to that question is no. And as a result, we will not charge these officers. Just a reminder, because this happens a lot and sometimes it's easy to mix up the cases because of the country we live in. So officers Terrence Mercadal and Jared Robinette responded to a vandalism complaint last March. After a brief pursuit, they turned a blind corner without announcing themselves and fired their weapons 20 times, hitting Clark at least 7 times. According to analysis by the New York Times, 6 of the shots likely hit Clark as he was falling or already on the ground. Many of them hit him in the back. Though the police claim they believe he was pointing a gun at them, Clark was unarmed and his cell phone was found under his body. 6 minutes passed before police offered any medical support. And that crops up so often in these cases where they know that they did something wrong. They mute their body cams while they get to talk about their strategy. And then a person is there, maybe could be saved, maybe doesn't have to die. But the police don't want to get involved at that point.
Right.
That is something that we see all too often.
Right, so instead they yell, hands up, put your hands, like, and the person is dying.
Yeah.
That happens so often. This is, you know, what's frustrating, I think, for a lot of people, and not even that, I don't even think people have faith in the further part of the justice system, that these people will actually, the jury will find these officers guilty. But just the fact that these cases don't even make it to a courtroom, I think is really frustrating.
It's not even worth looking into.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's insanity.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, granted, 90% of the time it gets to the jury lets them off. We understand that.
Right.
But let's at least have like the theater of justice. Let's at least entertain the fantasy that hypothetically this time it could be different. Let's talk about the other case. Oh, actually, so we had a little bit more on that. But I'm gonna move ahead to the US Department of Justice also. This is last Friday. Former police officer from Tulsa, Oklahoma would not face federal civil rights charges for killing Terrence Crutcher in 2016 in what she claimed was self-defense because she believed he was reaching into his car for a weapon. Crutcher had been holding up his hands and had no gun on either his person or in his vehicle. And those who say that he couldn't have been reaching for a weapon because his hands were in the air, their argument was bolstered by the fact that the entire thing took place on video.
Right, there was like helicopter footage, very clear.
Exactly.
Footage that he wasn't at all reaching into the car. And also, she already escaped, you know, state charges. She did go to trial for this. And yeah, it was like manslaughter charges or something.
Exactly,
like that.
In the family,
and
yeah.
And then I think she's still a police officer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Like we've covered so many of these cases. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you have to do to accidentally fall afoul of the law when you do something like this. Because how many of these have taken place totally on video? Every second of it. We in Chicago with Laquan McDonald, you have to wait like a year and a half to find out anything, even though all of it is there. 100% clear, you can watch it in video. It is incredibly frustrating sometimes to see not just the glacial pace of reform in this area, but under people like, you know, under Trump and under his Department of Justice, the actual backtracking of reforms in these areas.
Right.
Incredibly disheartening. I apologize for leaving on such a somber note, but this is America and this is the damage report. So we're gonna take a day's break, actually. We'll see you tomorrow. Lots more to get to, so buckle up. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.